Hello, I'm Nick DeSemlin, and welcome to a very special Hobbit spoiler special podcast in which myself and Phil DeSemlin, the killie to my filly, grill co-writer Philippa Boyens on the minutiae of the first movie in the trilogy, An Unexpected Journey. If you haven't seen the film yet, pause this and take the nearest available bunny sled to a multiplex. If you have seen it, prepare for 30 minutes of revealing chat, which takes in everything from Peter Jackson's cameo to the shocking truth behind Sebastian the Hedgehog. Enjoy.
Philippa Boyens, we're really thrilled to welcome you into the Empire podcast. Thank you for finding time to come and talk to us about The Hobbit.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate it. I thought a nice place to start would be just personally, Did you have a favourite moment in this film that you can share with us? Was there one thing that you really loved above all else?
Yes, there was actually. I saw it in the rushes and literally texted Martin Freeman after I saw it. It's the moment, I can say it now, can't I?
Yes.
It's the moment when he doesn't kill Gollum. Because there's no dialogue. It was just two really great actors working with each other. And it's such a huge moment in the actual canon of Professor Tolkien's mythology, that moment. And the repercussions, you know, both forward and backwards, are intense. But the way in which Martin played it, it just reinforced to me exactly why he was the right actor.
Yeah. What did he text you back?
It was something like that. He was like, really? Oh, thanks, Phil. Okay.
Because you scheduled that scene specifically. I mean, we were talking to Andy Serkis about it earlier today, and that was the first, those sequences were the first to be shot.
Yes.
Almost to give Martin an entree into the world. So he wasn't doing big ensemble scenes to start with. He had more intimate moments.
Yes. It's actually quite close to the book, that scene. We worked it up quite a bit and managed to include Sméagol into the scene along with Gollum, because Sméagol isn't really there in The Hobbit.
I enjoyed the line where he goes, I know this one. I loved that.
We know. Good. Yes. Yeah. Yes. We would, when you have someone like Andy Serkis, even though Sméagol isn't officially as present as he is in The Lord of the Rings, you know, because Andy had already brought this character to life in a way that so many people fell in love with, I mean, we felt we had to honour all of that. So yes, Sméagol makes an appearance. Although we had a debate because we named him in the scene, in the writing, and then it was Jay Bazalson, our editor, who said, you know, do you really want to do that? Because don't forget, he's forgotten his name in the Two Towers. It's Frodo who reminds him and calls him Sméagol. So if he's so self-aware that he's calling himself Sméagol, they're going to ruin that moment in Two Towers. And it was like, yes, you're right. So we took it out.
When you were writing these, did you work from the beginning to the end, or did you take a set piece like this and write that separately? Just get that out of the way. How did that?
We didn't. We spent a lot of time just structuring and trying to get the structure right before we write anything. Pete has a sense of some of the big set pieces that he wants to do in terms of the sort of what you'd call the landmarks of the plot, of the action, of the book, of the journey, and he starts working on those visually really early on in the process. So we start to see images coming through before we even start writing sometimes, which is actually a great gift as a screenwriter to be able to work with a director like that. But one of the first things I wrote was the very last scene in the film, this film that you see, because we tried very hard in structuring it to arrive at the door and to get there with the first film. We did try to do that, but we were losing so much in the process of trying to deliver them to the door, because we thought it was a natural ticking clock that is set up quite naturally in the story, and so we tried to get them to the door literally. And then when we found that we couldn't, because we were going to lose so much and or not be able to tell things in a proper way, that we So I thought I know how we can get to that door. And so that was actually one of the very first things I wrote in this script.
Can you share how the film was going to end? Was it with the barrels? Because there's been a lot of speculation. I don't know if you want to...
Yeah, what we did was... let me just say this. We arrived our characters at a geographical location, and we need to arrive them at this emotional location, which is really all about the relationship between Bilbo and Thorin. And it wasn't a story thread we wanted to keep going with. And that thread is that that Thorin has absolutely zero confidence in this little character, doesn't understand really why he's been brought along, which is, you know, not quite as defined in the book as we made it. But that's one of the things you have to do when you do an adaptation involving actors who want something to play, which I think is a good thing because it's what engages the film audience, certainly. So we didn't want to keep that thread sort of continually going for another bunch of sequences in the storytelling. And I think Martin Freeman in particular was really happy to get past that sort of fumbling, bumbling sort of I don't know how to find my courage or whatever.
Gold isn't really on Thorin's mind at all, is it? To any great extent, he's really thinking about his homeland.
He is,
which I guess. Changes the dynamic immediately between him and Bilbo from the book, potentially.
Yes.
Where he has more noble ambitions.
Well, if you look in the appendices, though, of The Lord of the Rings, that is absolutely, definitely where that comes from. I mean, there's a brilliant piece of writing in the appendices which speaks about Thorin. In fact, we use it. Cyrion Holm narrates the moment of him hammering away with the anvil. That's actually from the appendices. Mm-hmm. And he never forgave and he never forgot. So actually, it was always about homeland, I think, for Thorin. If you take The Hobbit within the context of the whole of the mythology that Professor Tolkien wrote about that story.
I loved the opening because you've got a big job to do to match the one in Fellowship, which is astonishingly big. But I think you pull it off. I wanted to stay there and see more of that stuff.
Yeah, and also, just having mentioned Cyrion Holm, what a brilliant job he did. Mm. So beautifully narrated, I think.
It's like 8 minutes of voiceover.
It is. It's 8 minutes of voiceover and completely engages you in the story. But also he is speaking to Frodo with great affection. And also it's also slightly confessional because he's kind of admitting that there was part of this tale that he did not tell him. And where that comes from is actually from the prologue of Lord of the Rings, where Professor Tolkien actually tries to... and actually also not just the prologue, it's actually also in the very opening chapters of the Lord of the Rings, but he tries to, I think, kind of explain in terms of storytelling the two different versions of that scene between Gollum and Bilbo Baggins and the finding of the ring, and whether or not that last question was a fair question. Or whether the fact that Gollum accepted it as a riddle means that it was all fair, or whether the ring came to Bilbo through him cheating or whatever. But the truth is he never actually told Frodo the truth, which I thought was really interesting. And I thought, well, you can take that. I know it's a small thread of story, but we liked the notion that he says, I may have told you the truth, I may not have told you all of it.
Given that this is a spoiler podcast, can I ask a question about Peter's cameo? Mm-hmm. Because I saw the Stephen Colbert show last week.
Yes.
He mentioned he was in the first 6 minutes, so I was keeping an eye out for him when I saw it again. Is he the dwarf that finds the Arkenstone?
No, he's not. Oh, my God. No, that's really funny, because that's actually a cameo by our stunt coordinator, our fight trainer, yeah.
Can you give any
secrets? Can I tell you who it is?
He's going to drive me mad.
Yes, he's someone who's fleeing from the dragon quite ignobly. So, yeah.
Flailing
there may have been a bit of pushing and shoving going on not a noble dwarf, shall we say. Actually, I don't know if I can swear on this.
You can absolutely swear.
Okay, well, because we did a gag, Richard Armitage and I did a gag when we were doing his ADR, and instead of telling them to run for their lives, he managed to quite brilliantly, actually, in sync, say, as he's hurrying this particular dwarf, who shall remain nameless, out of the way, and, you know, away from the dragon, he says, "Get out of the way, you fucking extra." And we didn't tell Pete we'd done it, so we just put it in the mix, and Pete being Pete, he just was like, "Okay, all right, yes, all right, well, it's in the film now."
Are you tempted to have a cameo? I don't believe you
no,
have done
never,
one yet.
Never. No, never. Not happening.
All right.
You mentioned, would love to know a bit more about the writing process for you, and also for, like, how you script the action moments. I mean, for instance, the big sequence in Goblin Town. Is that all kind of come out of the script, or are those kind of sequences developed with previs?
Definitely with well, put it this way, we try to earn those moments in terms of the storytelling, so that you care enough that they survive Goblin Town, because if you don't care, then we're all in trouble. But basically, when it comes to things like stone giants, like, they look up, you know, they need to find shelter because there's this huge thunderstorm going on. You reach that point where you know, okay, we've hit the stone giants, and basically Fran and I pretty much just go, "There you go, Pete."
Good luck.
Yeah, this one's your one. You know, you hand it over to him. But he writes, actually, his big print, as you know, you call it in a script, which is the descriptive passages, are always brilliant. They really give you a strong sense of what he wants to do. And I have to say, he's a bit of a page turner, Pete, when he writes, because he manages to carry that tension, and you literally want to keep turning the page of the script. So, yeah.
I read an interview with Fran Walsh recently, where she described your writing process and talked about how you and her sometimes write in bed.
In our pyjamas, yes. It's like we chucked in the towel. It's true, because we're neighbours. So my rush hour is navigating children and dogs and cats and crossing the lawn. And sometimes I have to admit, we're supposed to be starting at, you know, a certain time, and, you know, we know that, you know, certain things have got to be finished or done because of, you know, they've got to build the sets for a start and things like that. You know, often it starts with me calling her and she goes, "Oh, shit, I'm not dressed." And I go, "Well, it's all right, I'm not dressed either. Let's just start writing."
Put the kettle on, I'm coming
up. Yeah, well, pretty much.
Who makes the cocoa?
We both make it, actually. Actually, tea. It's usually tea, I have to say.
And Peter's a big tea drinker as well.
He is, although not with milk anymore. He's gone all herbal.
Has he? Okay, yes. All right. Are you still writing at the moment? When was the last time you wrote a line? Obviously, Five Armies is coming up.
Yes, we are. We're still writing. And last time we wrote a line, I think, was we rewrote one of the subtitles in the film about 2 weeks ago.
For film...
Film one.
Oh, for film one, really. So it's interesting, that's a change, isn't it? The orcs haven't previously talked in orcish, or have they?
The black speech.
With the black speech.
Yes, they have. Yes.
They have, they with subtitles.
Yes, we subtitled them. One of the things when the decision was made to be able to make three films was that we wanted to bring in the character of Azog the Defiler and be able to tell the Battle of Moria, as I think brilliantly narrated by Ken Stott, one of your great British actors that we managed to inveigle down to New Zealand. That was something that happened partially through the pickups, the character and development of Azog the Defiler, great name, was allowed to happen because we the decision was made to make three films.
Are there deleted scenes of him defiling things?
No, but the young actor who plays him, Manu Bennett,
he's from Spartacus.
He's from Spartacus. He's absolutely gorgeous, really gorgeous guy. And the girls on the crew decided that we were going to get T-shirts made which said, "You can defile me anytime."
That's some good merchandise.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about Azog, and I don't know how much he appears in the appendices, but can you kind of tell us a little bit about where he came from? And
yes, and he's Azog.
Sorry.
Yeah, I know. I Azog. Always Azog. Said yeah, Azog.
Okay.
I was always Azog, and I was also Smaug.
We were talking about that with Martin earlier. And he was saying that Peter kind of says it Smaug.
Smaug,
yeah.
Just out of interest, how do you know how it's pronounced?
Because we have brilliant dialect coaches, Roisin Cardi, who and Leith McPherson, who both worked on the film, and also David Silo, who does the translations for us, who's a Tolkien scholar.
There's no Tolkien audio in existence, is there?
I don't believe there is for that particular pronunciation of Smaug, but I think the argument is it's based on the German, and I'm going to say this wrong, Smaugen or something. Mm. So that's why
it's a German dragon.
But well, I think it's terribly English actually. If you read the text,
if he has a German accent in the first one. Azog.
Yes. Oh, yes. Going back to Azog, the Defiler, comes from the appendices. Mm. And he is actually meant to be dead and is actually killed by a character that we meet later on in this story. He wasn't much use to us dead, mainly because the revenge had been taken and we needed for it not to have been taken. And we also needed, we thought, a little bit more of a powerful through line between the orc, the giant orc who beheaded the king, the dwarf king, and the revenge that dwarf king's grandson would take. And it felt like to then remove it again by having it be the son of the giant orc who beheaded the king whose grandson is gone. You know, it was too much between
too many layers.
Yeah.
And the relationship between the goblins and the orcs, because there's kind of a hierarchy that you see in the scene in Goblin Town, and the message is sent to the pale orc. How did that kind of dynamic play out for you in terms of the storyline?
That was it's never explicitly said by Professor Tolkien that they are lesser, that the goblins are lesser. I think, although maybe it is, but what I do know is that goblins are orcs, and so therefore, and the Gundabad orcs are seemingly much more powerful. They certainly can march, although in The Hobbit they march under the cover not so much of darkness but a cloud cover of these giant bats and things. But that the goblins feel inferior, just certainly slightly more cowardly.
It has given rise to an office favourite, a new office favourite character, the little goblin that's in a sort of bucket. Oh, goes down the zip line.
With that wonderful laugh. The scribe.
Fantastic.
The goblin scribe.
So where did that come from?
That's Kieran Shah, who is our double. He's our stunt double. Our scale double. Actually, he does a lot of stunts. He was Frodo's scale double. And he's actually an actor in his own right, and so Pete wanted to give him a role, and he gave him the role of the Goblin Scribe. He's got you'll get to see a little, if they do an extended cut, you'll see a little bit more of him. But that wonderful cackle is genuinely him. Yeah,
it's a memorable moment.
Yeah,
and another character that we've taken a shine to is Sebastian the Hedgehog, and I guess that feeds into Radagast and the expansion of him into the story. Can you talk a little bit about that, how that worked out?
Yes, well, that was Pete. That was Peter. And he we talked about Radagast, and he asked me what I thought. In terms of the storytelling, we have two very powerful wizards in Saruman the White and Gandalf the Grey. We wanted a contrast to that, I think. We know from when I started talking to Peter about what the character could be and how he could be different. I loved the fact that he was slightly forgetful, or seemingly that way, and slightly more naive in The Lord of the Rings, as he's duped by Saruman. And so we came up with that eccentric, gentle, a wizard who spends most of his time a little bit like St. Francis, I think, less interested in the ways of the world and more interested in the natural world. So, and as soon as we came up with that character, I mean, Pete just went to town, and one day I remember he said, I've got an idea about how he can travel. And I said, okay, well, what's that? And he said, but a giant sleigh. And I was like, oh, okay, but that's slightly weird. You know, I was immediately thinking of reindeer and Santa Claus, and was this a good idea? And he said, drawn by huge bunnies, at which point I really did think he was on something. But of course, it's brilliant, and when you see it visually, that's why he does what he does.
It's quite a Lewis Carroll-y kind of feel to it.
It is. But though they were actually based on some rabbits that Peter had seen. And if you go online and Google German greys, you'll see the biggest bunnies you've ever seen in your life, but they're massive.
I enjoyed Saruman's I would love to see those two characters together, because I just enjoyed Saruman's like offhand remark about the mushrooms.
Yes.
But you know, obviously in Fellowship he does that line to Gandalf that your love of the halfling's leaf is I can't imagine what he thinks of Radagast.
Yes.
Are we going to get to see those two characters together at any point?
I can't tell you.
Possibly so. Okay, all right.
I was just going to ask if we were going to see more of Sebastian, to be honest.
Sebastian.
Like to see Sebastian in the Battle of Five Armies. With the,
Rallying the other hedgehogs. No, I think he stole enough of the scenes, perhaps. But he is very gorgeous.
He is lovely.
CGI, by the way.
I know. The wetter work is astonishing on it.
Yeah.
I know. I was actually in New Zealand at the time when there was a lot of debate about where the film was actually going to be shot. And I know for a while England was a possibility. Mm-hmm. How far did you... I mean, for me, it seems inconceivable that a Tolkien film wouldn't be made in New Zealand now. How far did you have to go down the sort of location scouting route in the UK at that point?
Oh, they did. They did. In fact, the book's probably sort of buried in Pete's office still. There were some very beautiful locations, of course, that you can be found here.
Were they location kind of spread around the country, or were there any particular areas that you'd...
Yeah, no, they were, actually. They did have a bit of trouble with the mountains.
We don't really do mountains. We have hills.
We do have hedgehogs.
Got Primrose Hill and hedgehogs.
But, it got to the point where they were... sort of suggesting to me that would I take my nanny with me, at which point I was like, you know, do you want to have the conversation with your nanny about going to England for like 18 months? And that's when it started to get way too real, and it was like, oh no, this can't, not because I don't love England and you know, English film crews and of course brilliant English actors, but it is New Zealand. I think the Middle Earth, there is something right about that mix.
I read a New Yorker piece on Guillermo del Toro a while back, and it described a few of his ideas. The dwarves were going to have spiky helmets. I remember being part of it. Can you sort of say anything about how the Guillermo draft was different to what we've ended up with?
I mean, it seems a bit unfair because we didn't really get to do as much work on it. So
sure.
I know I would truly, honestly have loved to have seen the film he would have made of The Hobbit. It would have been different. I think Bilbo was younger, not necessarily in age, more sort of naive. I think Pete's got, you know, we, down being colonials down in New Zealand, sort of grew up on those great English comedies and things like Dad's Army, dare I say it. And, you know, those wonderful characters that inhabit English humour. So I think the humour would have been more different, and Pete has a natural affinity for that sort of, I think we all do, for that English sensibility.
I enjoyed the stuffiness of, you know, the pocket handkerchief and
yes,
all that stuff.
I know, terribly English.
Yeah. Well, it was there a Guillermo idea that made it into the film that perhaps wouldn't have been in the film if he hadn't been involved?
I think, you know, just in broad strokes, I think the way in which what I've found is that he helped me fall back in love with Middle Earth. His enthusiasm was boundless, and he's a very passionate guy. He loves fantasy, loves the genre, has incredibly vivid imagination. So I think he helped me fall back in love with the world of Middle Earth, and there was a bit of trepidation there, you know, because you don't want to sort of repeat yourself.
Can you give us, I mean, I know you, this has been a spoiler podcast, but you don't want to spoil the next films, but can you give us just something on kind of what we can look forward to in The Desolation?
The Desolation.
I mean, we've seen some images of Bilbo and the massive pile of gold, and we talked to Martin Freeman about the scale, and the scale of the sets look incredible.
Mm. Lake Town, he loved it.
And Lake Town as well.
Oh, Lake Town's extraordinary, yes. Well, Stephen Fry is a treat to look forward to.
Stephen was working with Peter on Dambusters.
Yes.
Was that a factor in his involvement in this, or was that just incidental?
I think we've all been huge fan of Stephen's, so I think we probably would have gone there anyway. But I think it made it easier because it was an email kind of conversation as opposed to sort of having to formally approach somebody through, you know, agents and various things. But but also another thing to look forward to is a wonderful English actor called Ryan Gage, who plays Alfred and works brilliantly with the Master of Lake Town and is very, very funny. I mean, we've got, I think the wealth of new characters that you get to meet that invigorate the storytelling, just as I believe, you know, you meet Gollum for the first time in The Two Towers, you meet Rohan, you know, the culture of the great horseman in that tale, that you know, all of those things that helps, and Treebeard, that's what happens in this film. You get to meet Beorn, you get to meet the elves of Mirkwood, you get to meet Orlando Bloom again. I don't think that's a too big a spoiler. I think people realise that we've shot something with him, and you also get to meet his father, who was brilliantly played by Lee Pace.
On an elk.
A
majestic elk.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And what can you say about Toriel? Because that's a kind of a new character, isn't it?
Yeah, Tariel.
Sorry.
Sorry.
We'll have a listen afterwards.
Tariel.
Tariel.
Tariel, okay. Yeah. It's pretty. Daughter of Mirkwood, it means. Well, she was a creation. We deliberately came up with her because we could feel the weight of, as much as you love these rambunctious and, you know, tough and in some cases quite sexy, surprisingly sexy dwarves, as well as Bilbo and Gandalf, you fall in love with these characters, and it does become a little bit unrelentingly male, and we just knew that, you know, it needs that leaven, and it's about adding that dimension to the storytelling. It's not about sort of like selling dolls or merchandising or supposedly appealing to a female audience, because I think women are quite capable of loving a story with no women in it just for the sake of loving the story. But her character felt right. It's an invention of ours, but it's hopefully an invention within the spirit of Professor Tolkien, and actually her story thread, the germs of it, the seeds of it, lie within The Lord of the Rings, and a piece of storytelling that we never got to tell that involves an elf.
Okay.
Yes.
I know Arwen at one point was going to get involved in Helm's Deep, that battle.
Yes.
Why not bring Arwen back for these films, given that she is around?
Well, because we did actually think about that, actually.
Really?
We thought about every... I mean,
Aragorn
would bring everybody back, absolutely, just because we love all of them. We love the characters, but we also love the actors. And if we could, we'd probably try and find a way to, you know, get them all in there. But in the end, you know, it had to feel right and had to fit, and so it had. So it happens for the hopefully for the right reason. Galadriel returns for a very specific reason that has everything to do with Gandalf's story, and we know that part of the story because of the Lord of the Rings. So in The Hobbit, he disappears on the borders of Mirk. Well, it's not his first disappearance from the story, but it's his most significant on the borders of Mirkwood. He deliberately leaves the dwarves and Bilbo to fend for themselves and go off and do something incredibly important, and we get to tell you what he's doing and show you what he's doing. And that part of the story involves Galadriel as a member of the White Council.
I think we have to let you go now, unfortunately.
I wanted to ask one final question, if that's okay. Again, on the Stephen Colbert show, he said that he came down to the set and there was a Tolkien quiz.
And he said managed at a party.
And he said that he managed to beat you in the quiz.
Yes, he did.
What was the question that you got wrong?
Oh, no. He's told everybody he smoked me. Number one, he did not. He won by 3. And actually, some of those answers are in dispute by his own admission, because he wrote me a note afterwards and said, I think I might have got some of them wrong. But the truth was, Stephen Fry was actually the compere. Pete had this, he thought, hilarious idea. And then everyone had had a little bit of wine by then, and that we should have this Tolkien geek off. And the truth was, there was about 100 people at the party, and there was probably only Stephen and myself who knew whether we were getting the answers right or wrong. But to give him his due, he did beat me. But I did ask him some questions that he couldn't answer.
Could he pronounce Tariel?
Well, no, that wouldn't have been fair.
Seeing as it's your character.
but he does have an extraordinary love of those works, and I have a great deal of respect for him, even though he did beat me. And I don't know if I'd take him on again, I have to say. Well, not sober, anyway.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.